Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Happening now, President Biden is racing to break a stalemate and advance his agenda as new splits within his own party threaten to derail a long-sought spending deal. We're taking you inside the fever pitch negotiations with time running out. Also tonight, the January 6th Select Committee sets its sights on more Trump administration insiders seeking interviews with two former Homeland Security officials. This, as we're learning that at least five Trump-era White House staffers have indeed been cooperating with the investigation. And FDA advisors just voted to recommend Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine for children ages 5 to 11. 28 million kids here in the United States, now a critical step closer to being eligible to get their shots. We want to welcome our viewers here in the United States and around the world. I'm Wolf Blitzer. You're in the Situation Room. Let's go straight to the White House. Our CNN senior White House correspondent, Phil Mattingly, is joining us. Phil, the president is about to go overseas on Thursday. That's adding to the urgency right now to try to get this deal done.
Yeah, and Wolf, that urgency and the stakes of the moment have been repeatedly things that the president has tried to convey to lawmakers behind closed doors, in private conversations, I'm told, over the course of the last several days. He did so again today when he brought 12, almost more than a dozen House Democrats to the White House to try and urge them forward on his proposal. But there's no question about it. As they try and get to the finish line, there are still very real issues at play.
I've said this before, it's not going to be everything that he wants in this package.
Tonight, a clear message from the White House and Democratic leaders as negotiations hit a fever pitch.
There are realities of governing and realities of policymaking, including the fact that the alternative to what is being negotiated is not the original package. It is nothing.
Pressing congressional Democrats to unify as they work through the thorniest outstanding issues of Biden's $1.75 trillion economic and climate package, grappling with whether to scale back or eliminate entirely key elements like paid family leave, Medicaid, and Medicare expansion in the scale of climate provisions, not to mention a feverish scramble to finance the whole thing. All part of an effort to secure the commitments of key centrist senators Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona, and do so in roughly 48 hours as they press to finalize an agreement to bolster Biden's hand when he arrives at the UN Climate Change Conference.
It would be his preference. Yes, that's why we're pressing so hard.
Publicly, Democratic leaders pressing that even in a scaled-back form, it's a domestic agenda that would still rank amongst the most transformative in U.S. history.
We had the New Deal era. We had the Great Society Civil Rights era. We are on the verge of delivering the Build Back Better era. And we're closer than we've ever been.
A message also delivered behind the scenes by Speaker Nancy Pelosi to her caucus today, sources say, in the full court press to get Democrats behind the plan. It's an agreement that would clear the way to pass Biden's $1.2 trillion infrastructure proposal. But White House officials and Democratic leaders clear-eyed about the scale of the challenge.
Doing big things in Congress is always hard. But we didn't choose elected office just to pursue the easy things.
Yet those challenges spilling today into full view, with key progressive Senator Bernie Sanders breaking with Sinema and Manchin, and demanding the inclusion of prescription drug and Medicare expansion proposals.
Any reconciliation bill must include serious negotiations on the part of Medicare with the pharmaceutical industry, lower the cost of the prescription drugs. That's what the American people want. Any serious reconciliation bill must include expanding Medicare to cover dental, hearing aids, and eyeglasses.
As one critical question still remains unanswered, What will it take on the economic and climate package to ensure progressives will vote for Biden's infrastructure bill?
The agreement has always been that there was one big package. Might take multiple votes, but it's important that the pieces keep moving together.
After a meeting with House Progressive Leader Pramila Jayapal, Pelosi responding to Jayapal's shared position with Elizabeth Warren with this.
Speaker Pelosi, Congresswoman Jayapal just said that a framework agreement is not enough to vote for the bill.
Well, I think it is.
And Wolf, to kind of bookmark things, given how fluid everything is at this moment, there are really only two things that matter: what progressives need to be able to move forward on that infrastructure package, and whether or not the leadership and the White House can deliver that on the policy side of things. One thing to keep in mind here, the president is very willing to get involved and try and push progressives towards that vote if they reach a solid agreement on the second part of his domestic agenda. At this point, though, they're not there yet, Wolf.
They are not there yet. Phil Mattingly, I want you to stand by. I also want to bring in CNN's chief political analyst, Gloria Borger, and our senior political analyst, former presidential advisor, David Gergen. Gloria, high-stakes meetings, frantic negotiations, ultimatums. Isn't that exactly where the Democrats were a month ago when they blew past their original September deadlines?
It is, but it's also a little different, Wolf. I mean, nothing focuses the mind like a president who is going abroad and who has been calling people in saying, don't embarrass me. We need to have some kind of agreement here on climate before I go to this summit. Also, nothing focuses the mind like an election coming up next week, where you have two Democratic governors who are very, very much worried about this. The Democrats have to prove that they can be a governing majority. And I think you've got these Democrats running for election in New Jersey and Virginia who are saying, get something done. So you put those two things together, and there is a different kind of a feeling right now, which is they've got to get to the finish line. It's always a problem before it's not a problem. And so, you know, there's a lot of issues that remain to be resolved. But I think Democrats, progressives, as well as the moderates understand that they've got to get this done because this is about self-preservation at this point. If they fail, they will really fail, and they will hurt themselves, and they will hurt a Democratic president.
Yeah, of course, the president is flying to Rome on Thursday for the G20 summit. Then on Sunday, he flies from Rome to Scotland for the climate summit. David, as this spending plan gets whittled down, and it has been whittled down dramatically, Senator Bernie Sanders laid out his must-haves. As you heard, his support potentially could be at risk right now. What's it going to take for President Biden to break this logjam?
It's a very hard question these days, Wolf. You know, in the past, what normal politics meant was that you could have these fights right up until the end of the climax, and then people would come together, give up their differences, and move on. This doesn't smell like that at all. It smells like it's getting more complicated as the stakes get higher. You know, we didn't, who would have expected we'd be still talking about Medicare expansion? That wouldn't have been settled here on the threshold. Who would have expected we would be talking about immigration still? And they want to put that in the reconciliation bill where it has some real problems being part of the reconciliation bill. But I was the one that really surprised me, Wolf, in the last 24 hours is this emergence of a billionaire's tax, a tax on the top richest 10 people in the country, you know, which smacks of sort of class warfare. And beyond that, half of these 10 people have signed the giving pledge. They pledged to give away half their assets in philanthropy. And here they're being attacked, and they feel like they're under attack from this new plan emerging in the Senate. I'm really surprised to see that happen.
You know, Phil, Democratic Congressman Jimmy Gomez told Politico, and I'm quoting now, he said the Senate needs to start saying yes or no on issues and stop, in his words, effing talking. Just how high is the frustration level at this point?
Well, Wolf, as you know well, the frustration level with House members when it comes to the United States Senate is pretty much always at a peak level, but I think it's surpassed that over the course of the last couple of weeks. Look, there's a lot of frustration, and I think everybody understands the stakes here. This was the biggest thing that Democrats have tried to do in decades at this point in time. It's the most transformative, but also there are a lot of very specific things in this package that may be falling out or may be scaled back that a lot of individual members care deeply about. The recognition of what's happening and what the actual end game or outcome here is, I think, what you're hearing Democratic leaders and the president try and stress. You might not get your favorite thing, or it might not be as big as you want, but overall, this package is transformative. It's something we haven't been able to do at any point in the last 60 or 70 years. And I think the question right now is whether that pitch wins out. White House officials are confident that if they get far enough along, it will win out, but it is still an open question right now. And to David's point, this was a day that, even though they made progress on the policy side, no question about it, on the political side, and I think on the public comment side, it certainly looked like things were moving further apart at various points.
Yeah, it certainly looked like that. You know, Gloria, as you heard there, the progressive chair, Pramila Jayapal, is making it abundantly clear that just a framework, an agreement in principle, if you will, and a framework on the bigger spending bill won't be enough to get her caucus to vote for the traditional infrastructure bill. Do Democrats have a path forward after all these months of really hard work?
Well, and you heard what Nancy Pelosi said. You know, Pelosi says a framework is fine. We need a framework. And so I think they're all going to have to get together and decide either they trust each other or they don't trust each other. If you have a framework and say we're promising X amount on climate and we're promising to do this on Medicare, I don't understand how Democrats at this late date cannot get in a room and say to each other, we will trust you. This is what we're planning to do. It is remarkable to me that after all of this, these weeks, they can't seem to do that. And so you've got Pelosi saying one thing, Jayapal saying another. At a certain point, they have to say, okay, we're going to join hands here and get this done so we can save ourselves, so we can save the governors, those Democrats who are running for governor in Virginia and New Jersey, and get this done for the president of the United States.
David, deal or no deal?
I think there's going to be just a partial deal. They'll put off some of this till next year. It will be seen mostly as a negative by the press.
David Gergen, thanks very much. Gloria, Phil, guys, thanks to you as well. Coming up, CNN has learned that at least, get this, 5 former Trump White House officials are now in serious talks with the January 6th Select Committee investigating the insurrection. Just ahead, I'll ask a key member of the committee what he's learning from them. Stand by. Tonight, the January 6th Select Committee is taking direct aim at 2 former Trump officials who held top jobs at the Department of Homeland Security. Let's get some more from CNN's Ryan Nobles. He's joining us from Capitol Hill right now. Ryan, so what could the committee learn from these 2 former Department of Homeland Security officials?
Well, Wolf, this is significant because these 2 top DHS officials, Chad Wolf and Ken Cuccinelli, were in power during the time between the November election and what happened on January 6th. And we know during that time frame, the Trump White House was going to great lengths to try and get government agencies to get involved in what they believed, or at least tried to claim, was election fraud across the country. In fact, there's even a report of Rudy Giuliani, the former president's lawyer, at the time, reaching out to Ken Cuccinelli and suggesting that perhaps DHS needed to go in and impound some election voting machines across the country. So the committee could ask both of these men serious questions about the pressure campaign that was put on the Trump White House to the Department of Homeland Security during that period of time, and what, if anything, that could have possibly led to what we saw here on January 6th. We should point out, though, Wolf, at this point, they've just been asked to voluntarily ask questions from this committee. There's no sign yet that they've actually taken that step, Wolf.
We're also learning, Ryan, that at least 5 staffers who worked in the Trump White House are now talking to the committee. How significant is that?
It's very significant, Wolf, and it shows just how wide the net this committee is casting as it comes to try and find as much information as they can about who knew what and when during the lead up to January 6th and what happened on that day. And these 5 White House officials are above and beyond the ones that we've already known that they've issued subpoenas for, or even those that have come before the committee. Now, we don't know exactly what questions they're asking, but we do know they've been asking questions. They've been getting answers from some of these White House officials. And in addition to the 5 we know that have come forward and have voluntarily cooperated on some level, we've known they've asked questions of many others, some who've turned down their request to be interviewed. Wolf?
They might be subpoenaed. All right, Ryan Nobles on Capitol Hill, thank you very, very much. Let's discuss all this with a key member of the January 6th Select Committee, Congressman Pete Aguilar. Congressman, thanks so much for joining us. What are you learning from these former Trump White House staffers, at least five, we're told, who are actually now speaking with your committee?
Well, I'm not going to comment on the specifics of what we're hearing from them, but I will tell you that we have had dozens of interviews with individuals, and every day we're getting more information, more details about the events that transpired. And this is all in the pursuit of the truth, and that's what we have told the public that we're going to do and that we are undertaking, and it's what we've told our colleagues is our main focus, and that continues to be the goal that we have.
Does this group of former Trump White House officials, five of them, include the former communications official in the White House, Alyssa Farah? Are there any others you could tell us about?
Yeah, I can't tell you about the specifics and the individuals that we are in consultation with, but I can tell you that every day, you know, we are reaching out, we are pulling these threads to find out what transpired. And those interviews and those discussions are leading to more discussions that we're having. And so that becomes part of the investigative process that we're undertaking. And I just wanted to tip my hat to all the investigators and the attorneys who are helping us with this. They are doing an amazing job, and they're going to help us get to the truth.
And all these former officials who are answering questions, it's all under oath, right?
Well, some, it depends on the interview, but some are preliminary discussions, and then some could be interviews that are transcribed. And so there's various levels of interviews that we're undertaking, but we are keeping detailed notes. The committee is getting read out on the material, and we're taking an active role in searching for the truth here.
Your committee is also seeking testimony from two former, very high-ranking Trump officials from the Department of Homeland Security, Chad Wolf and Ken Cuccinelli. What specifically are you hoping to learn from them?
Well, what we have said specifically within the Department of Homeland Security is we want to know about the intelligence issues. We want to know what intelligence was out there, which was sent over to Capitol Police, what was not. And we want to know their role between the election day and January 5th and January 6th. They play a key role, and so we've asked them questions. We've asked questions of the National Archives as well for DHS material. And so that continues to be something that we want to get to the bottom of.
Republican Congressman Mo Brooks is denying that he had a role in planning the January 6th rally, but said he'd, quote, be proud, his word, proud, if any of his staff did help organize it. What questions does that raise for your investigation?
Well, I would hope that my colleague would also be proud then to come speak and to tell his side of the story and to get it on the record. But we want to get to the facts. We want to search for the truth. And anyone with information, whether they are a colleague of ours or not, should be willing and anxious to tell their story and to tell their perspective. But it's honestly disgusting that they would, you know, undertake that and that they would be that they would use those terms about the activities that happened. This from an individual who clearly questioned his own safety because he wore a flak jacket underneath when he went and spoke. At the Ellipse.
Congressman Pete Aguilar, thanks so much for joining us. We'll stay in close touch with you.
Thank you, Wolf.
Breaking news next, a very, very important recommendation on COVID vaccines that impacts 28 million American children. Our medical experts are standing by to discuss. We will when we come back.
Do your eyes bother you? Because after all these emails,
my eyes feel like a combo of stress, dry, and sandpaper.
Stry paper?
Why do we all put up with this? When there's new BioTrue Hydration Boost Eye Drops, BioTrue uses naturally inspired ingredients like an electrolyte, antioxidant, even your tear's own moisturizer, and no preservatives. These ingredients are true to your eye's biology. See? BioTrue.
I've made progress with my mental health. So when I started having unintentional body movements called tardive dyskinesia, I ignored them. But when the twitching and jerking in my face and hands affected my day-to-day, I finally had to say, it's not okay. It was time to talk to my doctor about Austedo. She said Austedo helps reduce TD movements in adults, while I continue with most of my mental health medications.
Austedo can cause depression, suicidal thoughts or actions in patients with Huntington's disease. Pay close attention to and call your doctor if you become depressed, have sudden changes in mood, behaviors, feelings, or have suicidal thoughts. Common side effects include inflammation of the nose and throat, insomnia, and sleepiness. Don't take Austedo if you have liver problems, are taking reserpine, tetrabenazine, or valbenazine. Austedo may cause irregular or fast heartbeat, restlessness, movements mimicking Parkinson's disease, fever, stiff muscles, problems thinking, and sweating.
Talk to your doctor about Austedo. It's time to treat TD. TD is not okay. Visit askforaustedo.com.
Bipolar depression. It made me feel like I was trapped in a fog.
This is art inspired by real stories of people living with bipolar depression.
I just couldn't find my way out of it.
The lows of bipolar depression can take you to a dark place and be hard to manage. Latuda could make a real difference in your symptoms. Latuda was proven to significantly reduce bipolar depression symptoms, and in clinical studies had no substantial impact on weight.
This is where I want to be.
Latuda is not for everyone. Call your doctor about unusual mood changes, behaviors, or suicidal thoughts. Antidepressants can increase these in children, teens, and young adults. Elderly dementia patients on Latuda have an increased risk of death or stroke. Call your doctor about fever, stiff muscles, and confusion, as these may be life-threatening, or uncontrollable muscle movements, as these may be permanent. These are not all the serious side effects.
Now, I'm back where I belong.
Ask your doctor about Latuda and pay as little as $0 for your first prescription.
Up to $1 million. That's how much University of Phoenix is committing to create 400 scholarships this month alone. Because we believe everybody deserves a chance. See what scholarships you may qualify for at phoenix.edu.
Their life was pretty perfect.
911 was amazing. I heard a gunshot.
How could somebody do this to their parent?
Killer Families. New episodes. Sundays at 11 on HLN.
Are your cupboards a cookware disaster? Well, try Gotham Steel Stackmaster, the all-new non-stick space-saving cookware that neatly stacks inside itself. Finally, you can have an organized kitchen with every pan and lid right at your fingertips. The solid metal stacking plates allow the entire set to fit together without scratching. Stackmaster pans are non-stick and durable. Plus, they're even oven-safe up to 500 degrees. So bake warm, cheesy bread or make your favorite oven pot roast. Even flames won't damage these pans. Get the full 10-piece Stackmaster cookware set for just four payments of $39.99. And we'll even ship it to you free. Plus, order now and get the free steamer basket that stacks perfectly with the rest of the set and the free fry basket that folds up to fit right inside the pot. But wait, we'll also send you this 5-piece utensil set absolutely free. That's a complete 17-piece set for only four payments of $39.99.
Call 1-800-671-7254 or go to GothamStackmaster.com.
I'm Will Ripley in Taipei, Taiwan, and this is CNN.
There's breaking news of the COVID pandemic tonight impacting 28 million American children. Just a little while ago, an FDA advisory panel voted to recommend that children here in the United States between the ages of 5 and 11 should be eligible for Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine. Let's dig deeper with CNN medical analyst Dr. Lena Wen. She's the author of the new book entitled Lifelines, A Doctor's Journey in the Fight for Public Health. Also with us, a key member of the FDA Vaccines Advisory Committee, Dr. Paul Offit. His new book is called You Bet Your Life, From Blood Transfusions to Mass Vaccination, The Long and Risky History of Medical Innovation. Dr. Offit, you were part of the FDA meeting today. Tell us why you voted to recommend the Pfizer coronavirus vaccine for these children ages 5 to 11. If you can, what was going on in your mind?
Well, the question is, do the benefits clearly and definitively outweigh the risks? And I think that's true. If you look at sort of what has happened to the 5 to 11-year-old so far, there's been about 1.9 million cases in that age group, about 8,300 hospitalizations. One-third of those hospitalizations have required an ICU admission. There's been about 2,000 cases of multi-system inflammatory disease and about 140 deaths. So children can suffer and be hospitalized and die from this virus. So then the question becomes, Is it safe? I mean, what do we know about the safety? Well, we know that there was a 2,400 child study, 1,600 got the vaccine, 800 got placebo, and there were 16 cases in the placebo group, 3 in the vaccine group, so an efficacy of 91% would appear effective. But what everybody worried about and what was the center of the discussion today was myocarditis, this inflammation of the heart. Will that be a problem here? And there were a lot of things that made us feel better. What made us feel better was that it looks like for the 12 to 15-year-old, the incidence of myocarditis is less than in the older group. That's good. It also looks like, and that's been true in the United States and Israel. And also, if you look at sort of classic myocarditis caused by viruses, it's usually sort of a post-pubertal, not pre-pubertal phenomenon. So I think all of that taken together made us feel that we knew enough to move forward on this vaccine for 5 to 11-year-olds.
Yeah, it's a very major moment indeed. Dr. Nguyen, if the FDA and the CDC join these advisors and approve this shot as expected, 28 million kids here in the U.S. could be eligible to get vaccinated in early November. That would have an enormous impact, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. It could have an impact on the trajectory of the pandemic, especially as we head into the winter. But I think the major difference is the change that it's going to make in parents' lives and in kids' lives. There are so many parents who've been really worried about sending their kids to school, especially if their school does not require masks. And to have that additional level of protection with the vaccine will be really game-changing. Also, kids have not had a normal existence since COVID. Many kids have not been in extracurriculars. They haven't had sleepovers and indoor birthday parties. And now with the vaccine, many kids will be able to resume so many aspects of pre-pandemic life. And so I think it's really important what Dr. Offit mentioned, that COVID-19 is really serious for younger children, and having this additional level of protection will help parents and kids have an additional peace of mind.
You're not only a physician, you're also a parent, Dr. Nguyen. What do you say to parents out there who might be hesitant about taking their young kids to get this shot?
I'd say that I totally understand. We as parents want the best thing for our children. There are going to be some parents who are already so sure that they want to be first in line, they'll do anything to get their kids vaccinated. I'd say if you're one of those parents, talk to your pediatrician, find out when you can get the vaccine. But if you're not sure yet, it's okay to wait and see what the experiences are of the kids who go first. And then if you have questions, talk to your pediatrician. We trust our pediatrician with other aspects of our kids' health. Let's trust them when it comes to the COVID-19 vaccine too.
Were you and your colleagues, Dr. Offit, on this advisory committee pretty united, or was there some serious debate going on?
Well, there was serious debate going on because it's a big deal. I mean, you're being asked to make a decision for millions of children based on studies really in thousands of children. So there's always a lot of careful looking at the data and making sure we all aired our concerns. But in the end, we all came down to voting yes. There was no one who voted no here. So I think we were united in that.
There was one abstention.
I think the decision that we make, when we make these kinds of decisions, it's all based on one thing. Would we give this vaccine to our own children? I think no one would have said yes if they weren't willing to give it to their own children.
Well, so what was the biggest concern?
Myocarditis. I think, you know, because you don't have a lot of data here. So you're trying to look at the totality of evidence in terms of what you can expect for the 5 to 11-year-old, what you've learned from the 12 to 15-year-old in this country and Israel, what you know about classic myocarditis, meaning the typical viral myocarditis that occurs in the 5 to 11-year-old. So all those sort of things. And it's also a lower dose. You know, the dose here is 10 micrograms per dose, not the 30 micrograms per dose that was given in the 12-year-old and above group. So I think all those things made us feel better that although myocarditis may happen, we think it would be very rare. And remember, I mean, how many people have died from myocarditis? None. How many 5 to 11-year-olds have died from COVID? So far, 143 and counting.
Yeah, it's a huge, huge moment indeed. Dr. Offit, thank you very much for all your important work. Dr. Nguyen, thanks to you as well. Just ahead, the New York Times is now reporting that criminal charges are indeed possible in the case of a deadly shooting on the set of the Alec Baldwin movie Rust. Stay with us. We have new information. We'll share it with you when we come back. We're following breaking news. The New York Times just now reporting that the Santa Fe County District Attorney is not ruling out criminal charges of the deadly shooting on the set of the Alec Baldwin movie Rust. CNN's Stephanie Elam has the latest.
It was life-threatening. It felt too surreal. Tonight, an actor from the film Rust describing in his own words the concerns he had for his own safety while filming shootouts.
When they shot at me, I actually did feel the blanks hitting my face and my body.
That firsthand account from Ian Hudson, an actor, telling TMZ that extra precaution was taken on set to protect the camera gear.
And the camera was protected by shield. So that made me question me being in front of the camera and sort of in between all of that fire. I would talk to my fellow cast members afterwards, and we all agreed how intense that was and how scary and real it was.
CNN has reached out to Hudson, but his manager said he is declining further interviews at this time. Another crew member, Serge Svetnoy, sharing what he called the last photo of Helena Hutchins on the set. Hutchins, shown in a tan hat with headphones to the right of a camera with Alec Baldwin in the background. It's unclear when the photo was taken. The production now shut down as more details emerge about what the set was like before the fatal shot fired by Alec Baldwin that killed the film's director of photography. According to The Wrap, during downtime in production, some crew members took the on-set weapons out for target practice, loading them with live rounds.
We learned that this happened the morning of the day that Helena Hutchins was killed in the early afternoon. So what happened between the time those guns came back with live ammunition in them and they should have been checked?
CNN has not been able to confirm The Wrap's reporting. New court documents obtained by CNN show the presence of ammunition on the set. Some found in boxes, some loose in a tray and in a fanny pack, and several spent casings along with three revolvers. The records do not indicate what type of ammunition was found, whether there were blanks, dummy rounds, or live ammo.
Hundreds of thousands of rounds are fired every year on these sets. As far as the live ammunition, there's no reason it should ever, ever have come onto the set.
An affidavit reveals the assistant director yelled, "cold gun," when he handed it to Baldwin, a term indicating the gun was not loaded with live ammo. But it was. The actor firing what he thought was a secured gun, instead killing Hutchins as she set up the camera shot and injuring Joel Souza, the film's director.
We need help immediately.
It's a tragedy many say they saw coming, including veteran prop master Neil Zoromsky, who told the LA Times he turned down the prop master job on Rust, calling the production an accident waiting to happen and warning corners were being cut on safety.
I impressed upon them that there were great concerns about that, and they really didn't really respond to my concerns about that.
Now, CNN has reached back out to Rust Productions to comment on these allegations that are being presented by The Wrap, and they referred us back to a statement they had previously put out, which said they had not received any official complaints about safety with props or weapons on the set of Rust. It's also worth noting that the state of New Mexico also adding that they did not receive any complaints about safety on that movie set either. Wolf?
See you then, Stephanie Elam, Santa Fe, New Mexico. Stephanie, thank you very much. Let's get some more on all of this. Joining us now, the chief correspondent for Inside Edition, Jim Murray. Jim, thanks very much for joining us. I know you well. You're an attorney. Given this news that the Santa Fe County District Attorney is not necessarily ruling out criminal charges, what do you think?
Well, I certainly understand that one of the potential charges could be negligent homicide. You don't need an intent to hurt or kill to bring charges of negligent homicide, but you do have to have a situation where your wanton disregard for the safety of others could cause injury or death. And in this case, you've got a situation where you have a real gun on the set. This was a real gun that Alec Baldwin used. It's not a prop gun. It's not a toy. It's capable of shooting real weapons, as we see with this horrible fatality. And then when you hear that the gun was not under lock and key as it should have been, when you hear that there were live rounds on a set, which there never should have been, these weapons should have been under lock and key and under the sole custody of the armorer or the property master, and they need to be checked each time they come out and each time they're handed to an actor, each time they're put on a table. You never hand a weapon to anyone without showing it to them, without checking to make sure it is safe. And so in that sense, it doesn't surprise me that potentially the assistant director or potentially the armorer or possibly even Alec Baldwin in his role as an executive producer could potentially face criminal charges. That doesn't mean you'll see that, but it means it's a possibility.
Yeah, certainly is. And as you know, these court documents obtained by CNN showed the ammunition was found on the set, some in a fanny pack, some in boxes, some loose ammunition out there. Does ammo like this belong on a movie set? First of all, real ammunition at all?
Absolutely not. We talked to several property masters. I talked to Neil Zoromsky, the person that Stephanie Elam had in her report. He was nearly in tears this morning when I talked to him because he saw this accident waiting to happen. You never need live ammo on the set, and especially in a situation where you don't have that ammo under lock and key and the weapons under constant surveillance. So the short answer is no, you should never have live ammo on the set, specifically because it's easy to mix it up.
We've been showing our viewers, Jim, this photo. We believe it to be the last photo of Helene Hutchins. She's in front of the camera with the jacket, the hat, the tan jacket over there. Walk us through what you know, because I know you've been doing a lot of reporting on this.
Well, as best we're able to determine now, based upon reports, she was behind the camera, but this was a rehearsal situation. So I don't believe that footage was rolling. But imagine what she was seeing. Imagine what Alec Baldwin was seeing. You know, your heart has to go out to Alec Baldwin because he's left with this memory really seared in his mind of what he saw. The last thing in the world he expected was to see that bullet not only hurt and kill his cinematographer, but also the director. And just thinking of it is haunting.
Jim Murray, thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Coming up, we're learning damning new information about the spread of hate speech on Facebook. I'll speak with the head of the Anti-Defamation League about the dangers posed by the social media giant. Facebook is under enormous fire tonight after new documents reveal the company's apparent indifference to hate speech spreading on its platforms. For more on that, we're joined by the CEO and National Director of the Anti-Defamation League, Jonathan Greenblatt. Jonathan, thank you very much for joining us. You say, and this jumped out at me, you say, and I'm quoting you now, "I don't think ever before a single company has been responsible for so much misfortune." That's an incredibly bold statement. Explain what you mean.
Well, what we've learned through the release of the Facebook files, Wolf, is that many of the things that watchdogs like ADL had been saying, that activists had been claiming, all turns out to be true and then some. And the situation is very simple. We knew that the platform was perpetuating anti-Semitism and racism, extremism and hate. What we didn't know, what we couldn't even, it's hard to believe, is how much management knew. I mean, it's shocking in some ways and still even surprising to learn that despite the fact that the management understood, for example, that certain extremist groups, thousands of them, should be banned, they kept them up on the site. When they set up experimental accounts, Wolf, to see how they responded, like conservative accounts, a woman in North Carolina, in less than 48 hours, the account was inundated with QAnon conspiracies. And they knowingly misled legislators and the public about the role of Facebook in promoting the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol. So whether it's promoting extremism in America, allowing the kind of hate in places like Asia that led to the slaughter of Rohingya Muslims or Indian Muslims, or even encouraging young girls to question their own self-esteem. Like, there is so much damage done here. You know, for a long time, Mark Zuckerberg said that he saw himself as like Steve Jobs. I think the right analogy, Wolf, is Mark Zuckerberg is more like Joe Camel. Because like Big Tobacco, Facebook needs once and for all to be stopped.
Yeah, I know you're exploring, the ADL is exploring, Jonathan, responses to these revelations. That could involve advertisers. How do you hold a company like Facebook accountable?
It's a great question. You know, Facebook is a behemoth. Their earnings yesterday announced $29 billion in the third quarter alone. There's never been a tech company with this kind of, that's grown with such scale and such sophistication in such a short amount of time. They have nearly 3 billion users, but they can be held accountable. Advertisers need to ask, do they want to subsidize such reckless behavior? Employees need to ask, do they want to enable such indifference, as you called it? And I think legislators need to ask whether it's time to finally rein in a company that put profits over people. And there are different steps from the White House to Congress that government can take to finally, once and for all, get Facebook in line.
All right, Jonathan Greenblatt, I know you guys are working on this big time. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Up next, President Biden heading to the Vatican this week to visit with Pope Francis, but it's not their first meeting. We have details of their unique relationship. That's next. Two of the world's most powerful men are poised to meet this Friday when President Joe Biden calls on Pope Francis at the Vatican. CNN's Brian Todd is joining us. He's got details for us. They already have a special relationship, don't they?
They have a relationship, Wolf, that's based on more than their similar views on issues like climate change. This is a strong personal connection based on respect, faith, and dealing with loss.
As we Catholics say, oh my God.
A president with a devout and humble relationship with his faith prepares tonight to meet what observers say is a kindred spirit at the Vatican on Friday. Joe Biden is only America's second Roman Catholic president. And when he meets with Pope Francis at the Vatican, he'll be the second Catholic president to meet with the head of the Catholic Church after John F. Kennedy did it 58 years ago.
For Biden in particular, getting the kind of warm embrace that he will certainly get on Friday from Pope Francis, that is tremendously important.
It's important, analysts say, not just because the two men share viewpoints on the issues of climate change, the pandemic, and fighting poverty. This connection, they say, is personal and deeply so.
In the life of Joe Biden, Catholicism has played a very important role to sustain him in the tragedies that he had to face. That has been particularly true for the death of his son, Beau.
In 2015, Pope Francis visited the U.S. just months after Joe Biden had lost his son, Beau, to cancer. During the visit, Biden escorted the Pope at several of his stops. Biden later recalled that as he was saying goodbye to the Pope in Philadelphia, Francis asked to meet with Biden's family and offered them comfort over the loss of Beau.
He provided us with more comfort than even he, I think, will ever understand.
But this visit also comes as Biden's broader relationship with the church experiences complications, some influential church leaders displeased with the president.
There are some Catholics, including some bishops in the United States, who believe that by supporting abortion rights and thereby contradicting the clear moral teaching of the Catholic Church on abortion, President Biden has, in effect, put himself outside the fold, and as such, should not be eligible to receive communion when he comes to Mass.
But John Allen says that's a position Pope Francis himself does not agree with. The bond between these two leaders, analysts say, extends to the paths they've taken to the top. Two men who were written off earlier when the top positions in their arenas were heavily contested.
They ascended to power, to the top position, very late in their lives, later than anyone would expect for them to arrive there. And so in some sense, they are survivors.
And analysts say there's another reason Pope Francis will be happy to greet the president on Friday, and that's because the president is not Donald Trump. Trump and Pope Francis had a strained relationship after Francis criticized Trump's plan to build a wall at the border, saying, quote, it's not Christian to build barriers. Trump, of course, fired back, calling Francis's comments disgraceful. Wolf.
Ryan Todd, excellent report. Thank you very, very much. And to our viewers, thanks very much for watching. I'm Wolf Blitzer in the Situation Room. Aaron Burnett out front starts right now.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country. Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.